It was the first coronation Vimes had attended. He'd expected it to be stranger, touched somehow by glory. Instead, it was dull, but at least it was a big dull, dullness distilled and cultivated over thousands of years, until it had developed an impressive shine, as even grime will if you polish it long enough. It was dull, hammered into the shape and form of ceremony. It had also been timed to test the capacity of the average bladder. A number of dwarfs read passages from ancient scrolls. They were what sounded like excerpts from the Kaboldian saga, and Vimes wondered desperately if they were in for another opera. But they were over after a mere hour. There were more readings from different dwarfs. At one point the king, who had been standing alone in the centre of a circle of candlelight, was presented with a leather bag, a small mining axe, and a ruby. Vimes didn't catch the meaning of any of this, but by the sounds it was clear that each item was of huge and satisfying significance to the thousands who were standing behind him. Thousands? No, there must be tens of thousands, he thought. The bowl of the cavern was full of tier upon tier of dwarfs. Maybe 100,000. And he was in the front row. No one had said anything. The four of them had simply been led there and left, although the murmurings suggested that the presence of detritus was causing considerable attention. Senior, long-bearded, and richly clothed dwarfs were all around them. Someone was being taught something. Vimes wondered who the lesson was directed at. Finally, the scone was brought in, small and dull, and yet carried by 24 dwarfs on a large bier. It was laid reverentially on a stool. He could sense the change in the air of the huge cavern, and once again he thought, "There's no magic, you poor devils, there's no history. I'll bet my wages the damn thing was moulded with rubber from a vat that had last been used in the preparation of Sonkey's Evershore Dependables, and there's your holy relic for you." There were more readings, much shorter this time. Then the dwarfs who had been participating in the endless and baffling hours withdrew from the centre of the cavern, leaving the king looking as small and alone as the scone itself. He stared around him, and although it was surely impossible for him to have seen Vimes among the thousands in the gloom, it did seem that his gaze rested on the Ankh-Morpork party for a fraction of a second. The king sat down. A sigh began. It grew louder and louder, a hurricane made up of the breath of a nation. It echoed back and forth among the rocks until it drowned out all other sounds. Vimes had half expected the scone to explode or crumble or flash red hot. "Which was stupid," said a dwindling part of himself. "It was a fake, a nonsense, something made in Ankh-Morpork for money, something that had already cost lives. It was not, it could not be real." But in the roaring air he knew that it was, for all who needed to believe, and in a belief so strong that truth was not the same as fact. He knew that for now, and yesterday, and tomorrow, both the thing and the whole of the thing. Angua noticed that Carrot was walking better, even as they reached the forest below the falls, and the shovel over his shoulder hardly burdened him at all. There were wolf prints all over the snow. "They won't have stayed," she said, as they walked between the trees. "They felt things keenly when he died, but wolves look to the future. They don't try to remember things."
"They are lucky," said Carrot.
"They're realistic. It's just that the future contains the next meal and the next danger."
"Is your arm all right?"
"It feels as good as new."
They found a freezing mass of fur lying at the water's edge. Carrot pulled it out of the water, scraped off the snow higher up the shingle, and started to dig. After a while he took off his shirt. The bruises were already fading. Angua sat and looked over the water, listening to the thud of the spade and the occasional grunt when Carrot hit a tree root. Then she heard the soft slither of something being pulled over snow, a pause, and then the sound of sand and stones being shovelled into a hole.
"Do you want to say a few words?" said Carrot.
"You heard the howl last night. That's how wolves do it," said Angua, still looking out across the water. "There aren't any other words."
"Perhaps just a moment's silence, then." She spun round. "Carrot, don't you remember last night? Didn't you wonder what I might become? Didn't you worry about the future?"
"No."
"Why the hell not? It hasn't happened yet."
"Shall we get back? It'll be dark soon."
"And tomorrow?"
"I'd like you to come back to Ankh-Morpork."
"Why? There's nothing for me there."
Carrot patted the soil over the grave. "Is there anything left for you here?" he said. "Besides, I—" "Don't you dare say the words," Angua thought. "Not at a time like this." And then they both became aware of the wolves. They were creeping through the trees, darker shadows in the evening light. "They're hunting," said Angua, grabbing Carrot's arm.
"Oh, don't worry. They don't attack human beings for no reason."
"Carrot."
"Yes?"
The wolves were closing in.
"I'm not human."
"But last night—"
"That was different. They remembered Gavin. Now I'm just a werewolf to them."
She watched him turn to look at the advancing wolves. The hairs were up on their backs. They were growling. They moved with the strange sidle of those whose hatred could just manage to overcome their fear. And at any moment, that balance in one of them was going to tip all the way, and then it would be all over. There was a leap, and it was Carrot who made it. He grabbed the lead wolf by its neck and tail, and held on as it struggled and snapped. Its frantic efforts to escape resulted only in it running in a circle with Carrot in the middle, the other wolves backing away from the whirl of grey. Then, as it stumbled, he bit it on the back of the neck. It screamed. Carrot let go and stood up. He looked at the circle of wolves. They shied away from his gaze.
"Hmm?"
he said. The wolf on the ground whined and got to its feet awkwardly.
"Hmm?"
It tucked its tail between its legs and backed off, but it still seemed to be attached to Carrot by an invisible lead.
"Angua," said Carrot, still watching it carefully.
"Yes?"
"Can you speak wolf, I mean, in this shape?"
"A bit."
"Look, how did you know what to do?" "Oh, I've watched animals," said Carrot, as if that was an explanation. "Please tell them. Tell them if they go away now, I won't harm them."
She managed to bark out the words. It had all changed in such a tiny handful of seconds. Now Carrot wrote the script.
"And now tell them that although I'm going away, I may be back. What's the name of this one?"
He nodded at the cowering wolf.
"That's Eats Wrong Meat," Angua whispered. He's the leader. Now Gavin's gone." "Then tell them that I'm quite happy that he should go on leading them. Tell them all that."
They watched her intently. She knew what they were thinking. He'd beaten the leader. It was all sorted out. Wolves did not have a lot of mental space for uncertainty. Doubt was a luxury for species that did not live one meal away from starvation. They still had a Gavin-shaped hole in their minds, and Carrot had stepped into it. Of course it wouldn't last long, but it didn't need to. "He always, always finds a way in," she thought. "He doesn't think about it. He doesn't plot. He simply slides in. I saved him because he couldn't save himself, and Gavin saved him because he had some reason. And I'm almost, almost certain that Carrot doesn't know how he manages to wrap the world around him. Almost certain. He's good and kind, and born to be a king of the ancient sort that wore oak leaves and ruled from a seat under a tree. And though he tries hard, he never had a cynical thought. I'm almost certain."
"Let's go now," said Carrot. "The coronation will be over soon, and I don't want Mr. Vimes to worry."
"Carrot, I've got to know something."
"Yes?"
"That might happen to me. Have you ever thought about that? He was my brother, after all. Being two things at the same time, and never quite being one, we're not the most stable of creatures."
"Gold and muck come out of the same shaft," said Carrot.
"That's just a dwarf saying."
"It's true, though. You're not him."
"Well, if it happened, if it did, would you do what Vimes did, Carrot? Would it be you who picked up a weapon and came after me? I know you won't lie. I've got to know. Would it be you?"
A little snow slid down from the trees. The wolves watched. Carrot looked up for a moment at the grey sky, and then nodded. "Yes."
She sighed. "Promise," she said. Vimes was surprised at how quickly a coronation became a working day. There was a flourish of echoing horns, a general flow of the crowd, and gradually a queue in front of the king.
"They haven't even given him time to get comfy," said Lady Sybil as they headed towards the exit.
"Our kings are working kings," said Cheery.
and Vimes detected the pride in her voice. "But now is the time when the king awards favours."
A dwarf caught up with Vimes and tugged his cloak respectfully.
"The king wishes to see you now, Your Excellency," he said. "There's an almighty queue. Nevertheless," the dwarf gave a polite cough, "the king wishes to see you now, all of you."
They were led to the front of the queue. Vimes felt many eyes boring into the small of his back. The king dismissed the previous supplicant with a regal nod as the Ankh-Morpork party was deftly inserted at the top of the line, supplanting a dwarf whose beard went down to his knees. The king looked up at them for a moment, and then the internal filing system threw up a card.
"Ah, it's yourselves, good as new," he said. "Now what was it I was going to do? Oh, I remember. Lady Sibyl." She curtsied. "Classically we give rings at this time," said the king. "Between ourselves, many dwarfs consider this a bit, well, bath salts, see. But I believe they are still welcome, and so this, Lady Sibyl, is perhaps a token of things to come."
It was a thin silver ring. Vimes was taken aback at this parsimony, but Sibyl could accept a bunch of dead rats graciously.
"Oh, how one—"
"We normally give gold," the king went on. "Very popular, and of course you can sing about it. But this has rarity value, see? It is the first silver that has been mined in Ubervald in hundreds of years."
"I thought there was a rule that—"
Vimes began.
"I ordered the mines reopened last night," said the king pleasantly. "It seemed an auspicious time. We shall soon have ore for sale, Your Excellency, but if Lady Sibyl doesn't get involved in the negotiations and bankrupt us, I for one shall be very grateful."
The king added,
"Miss Littlebottom, I see, has not graced us with a sartorial extravaganza today."
Cheery stared.
"You're not wearing a dress," said the king.
"No, sire."
"Although I do note a few unobtrusive touches of mascara and lipstick."
"Yes, sire,"
squeaked Cheery, on the point of death through shock.
"There's nice. Do be sure to let me know the name of your dressmaker," the king went on. "I may have some custom for her in the fullness of time. I've thought long and hard—"
Vimes blinked. Cheery had gone pale. Had anyone else heard that? Had he? Sibyl nudged him in the ribs.
"Your mouth's open, Sam," she whispered.
So he had heard it.
He heard the king's voice again. "And a bag of gold is always acceptable."
Cheery was still staring. Vimes shook her gently by the shoulder.
Thank you, sire."
The king held out his hand. Vimes wobbled Cheery again. Completely hypnotized, she extended her hand. The king took it and shook it. Shocked whispers were spreading behind Vimes. The king had shaken the hand of a self-declared female.
"And that leaves detritus," said the king. "What a dwarf should give a troll is, of course, a bit of a puzzle. But it occurs to me that what I should give you is what I would give a dwarf. A bag of gold, then, for whatever purpose you choose to use it. And—"
He stood up. He held out his hand. Dwarfs and trolls were still fighting in the further regions of Ubervald, Vimes knew. Elsewhere, there was at best the sort of peace you got when both sides were busy rearming. The whispering stopped. Silence spread out in a widening circle all across the floor of the cave. Detritus blinked. Then he took the hand very carefully, trying not to crush it. The whispering started again, and this time Vimes knew it had go for miles. It occurred to him that in two handshakes the white-bearded elderly dwarf had done more than a dozen devious plots could have achieved. By the time those ripples reached the edge of Ubervald, they would be tidal waves. 30 men and a dog would be nothing by comparison.
"Hm?" "I said, what can a king give a Vimes?" said the king.
Nothing, I think,"
said Vimes absently. Two handshakes, and very quietly, smiling, the king had turned the customs of the dwarfs upside down. And so gently, too, that they'd spend years arguing about it.
"Sam," snapped Sibyl.
"Well, then, I shall give something to your descendants," said the king, apparently unperturbed.
A long, flat box was brought to him. He opened it to reveal a dwarf axe, the new metal glinting on its nest of black cloth.
"This will become, in time, the axe of someone's grandfather," said the king. "And no doubt over the years it will need a new handle or a new blade, and over the centuries the shape will change in line with fashion, but it will always be, in every detail and respect, the axe I give you today. And because it'll change with the times, it'll always be sharp. There's a grain of truth in that, see? So nice to have met you. Do enjoy your journey home, Your Excellency.
The four were silent in the coach back to the embassy. Then Cheery said, "The King said."
"I heard," said Vimes.
"That was as good as saying that he is a "Things are going to change," said Lady Sibyl. "That's what the King was saying."
"I never shook hands with no king before," said Detritus. "No dwarf either come to dat."
"You shook hands with me once," said Cheery.
"Watchmen don't count," said Detritus firmly. "Watchmen is watchmen."
"I wonder if it'll change anything," said Lady Sibyl.
Vimes stared out of the window. It would probably make people feel good, he thought. But trolls and dwarfs have been fighting for centuries. Ending that sort of thing took more than a handshake. It was just a symbol. On the other hand, the world wasn't moved by heroes or villains or even by policemen. It might as well be moved by symbols. All he knew was that you couldn't hope to try for the big stuff, like world peace and happiness, but you might just about be able to achieve some tiny deed that would make the world, in a small way, a better place. Like shooting someone.
"I forgot to say that I thought it was very kind of you, Cheery," said Lady Sibyl. "Yesterday, when you comforted Dee."
"She would have had me killed by the werewolves," said Vimes.
He felt this was a point worth making.
"Yes, of course, but it was kind anyway," said Sibyl.
Cheery looked at her feet, avoiding Sibyl's gaze. Then she coughed nervously and pulled a small piece of paper out of her sleeve, which she handed wordlessly to Vimes. He unfolded it.
"She gave you these names," he said. "Some of these are very senior dwarfs in Ankh-Morpork."
"Yes, sir," said Cheery. She coughed again. "I knew she wanted someone to talk to, and I suggested a few things she might like to talk about. Sorry, Lady Sibyl, it's very hard to stop being a copper."
"I worked that one out a long time ago," said Sibyl.
"You know," said Vimes, to break the silence,
"if we leave at first light tomorrow, we could be through the pass before sundown."
And it was a comfortable night, somewhere in the depths of the feather mattress. Vimes awoke a couple of times and thought he could hear voices. Then he sank back into the softness and dreamt of warm snow. He was shaken awake by Detritus.
"It's getting light, sir."
"Hm?"
"And there's a Igor and a young man out in the hall," said Detritus. "He got a big jar full of noses and a rabbit covered in ears."
Vimes tried to get back to sleep. Then he sat bolt upright. "What?"
"It's all covered in ears, sir."
"You mean one of those rabbits with big floppy ears?"
"You better come and see this rabbit," sniffed the troll.
Vimes left Sibyl wallowing in sleep, pulled on his dressing gown and pattered barefoot down to the freezing hall. Igor was waiting anxiously in the middle of the floor. Vimes was getting the hang of Igor recognition. The key was in the pattern of scars, and this was a new one. He was with a much younger man, probably barely out of his teens, at least in places, but already the scars and stitching indicated that relentless urge towards self-improvement that was the hallmark of a good Igor. They just never seemed to be able to get the eyes level.
"Your Excellency?"
"You're Igor, right?"
"Amazing guess, sir. We haven't met before, but I work for Dr. Thalmick on the other side of the mountain, and this is my son, Igor."
He smacked the young man around the back of his head.
"Say hello to his grace, Igor."
"I don't believe in the peerage," said young Igor sulkily, "nor shall I call any man master."
"See," said his father, "sorry about this, your grace, but this is a younger generation for you. I hope you can find a job for him in the big city, 'cause he's totally unemployable in Oberwald. But he's a very good surgeon, even if he does have funny ideas. He's got his grandfather's hands, you know."
"I can see the scars," said Vimes.
"Lucky little devil, they sort of mean mine by rights, but he was old enough to go into the lottery."
"You want to join the watch, Igor?" said Vimes.
"Yes, sir. I believe Ankh-Morpork is where the future lies, sir."
His father leaned closer to Vimes.
"We don't mention his slight speech impediment, Master," he whispered. "Of course, it counts against him here, you know, in the Igor business. But I'm sure people will be kind to him in Ankh-Morpork."
"Yes, indeed," said Vimes, removing his handkerchief and absent-mindedly dabbing his ear. "And, this rabbit?" "He's eerie, sir." "Good name, good name. Is that why he's got human ears all over his back?" "Early experiment, sir." "And, the noses?" "There were about a dozen of them in a large screw-top pickle jar. And they were just noses. Not cut off anyone, as far as Vimes could see. They had little legs and were jumping hopefully up and down against the glass, like puppies in a pet shop window. He thought he could hear faint whee noises." "The wave of the future, sir," said young Igor. "I grow them in special vats. I can do eyes and fingers, too." "But they've got little legs." "Oh, they wither off in a few hours after they're attached, sir. And they want to be useful, my little noses. Bio-artificing for the next century, sir. None of that outmoded cutting up of old bodies." His father smacked his head again.
You see, what's the point in that, wastrel? I hope you can do something with him, Master, because I've just about given up. Not worth breaking down for spares, as we say."
Vimes sighed. Still, losing small extremities was a daily hazard in the watch, and the lad was, after all, an Igor. It wasn't as if there were any normal people in the watch. He could afford to put up with a nose breeder in exchange for surgery that didn't involve screaming and buckets of boiling pitch. He indicated a box beside the young man. It was growling and rocking from side to side. "You haven't got a dog too, have you?" he said, trying to make it sound like a joke. "That's my tomatoes," said young Igor. "A triumph of modern Igoring. They grow enormously."
"Only because they viciously attack all other vegetables," said his father. "But I'll say this for the lad, Master. I've never known anyone like him for really tiny stitching."
All right, he sounds like the man I'm looking for," said Vimes. "Or close, at least. Take a seat, young man. I just hope there's going to be room in the coaches." The door to the yard swung open, blowing in a few snowflakes, and Carrot, who stamped his feet. "A bit of snow overnight, but the road looks open," he said. "They say there's a really big one due tonight, though, so we—" "Oh, good morning, sir." "You're fit enough to travel," said Vimes. "We both are," said Angua. She crossed the hall and stood next to Carrot. Once again Vimes was aware of a lot of words that he hadn't heard. A wise man didn't make inquiries at a time like this. Besides, Vimes could feel the cold coming up through his feet. He reached a decision. "Give me your notebook, Captain," he said. They watched him scribble a few lines. "Stop at the Clax Tower and send a message on to the yard," he said, handing it back to Carrot. "Tell them you're on the way. Take young Igor here with you and get him settled in, okay? And make a report to his lordship."
You're not coming," said Carrot.
"Her ladyship and I will take the other coach," said Vimes. "Or buy a sleigh. Very comfy things, sleighs. And we'll just take it a little easier. We'll see the sights. We'll dawdle along the way, understand?" He saw Angua smile, and wondered if Sybil had confided in her.
"Absolutely, sir," said Carrot.
"Oh, and go along to Burley and Strong in the Arms, order a couple of dozen of everything off the top of their small arms catalogue, and get them on the next mail coach due for Bonk for the personal attention of Captain Tantony."
"The mail coach rate will be very expensive, sir," Carrot began.
"I didn't want you to tell me that, Captain. I wanted you to say, yes, sir."
"Yes, sir."
"And ask at the gate about three gloomy biddies who live in a big house near here. It's got a cherry orchard. Find out the address, and when you get back, send them three coach tickets to Ankh-Morpork."
"Right, sir."
"Well done. Travel safely. I'll see you in a week. Or two. Three at the outside. All right?" A few minutes later, he stood shivering on the steps, watching the coach disappear into the crisp morning. He felt a pang of guilt, but it was only a little pang. He gave every day to the watch, and it was time, he thought, for it to give him a week. Or two. Three at the outside. In fact, he realized, as pangs went, it was barely a ping, which was, he recalled, a dialect word for water meadow. Right now he could see a future, which was more than he'd ever had before. He locked the door and went back to bed. On a clear day, from the right vantage point on the ramtops, a watcher could see a very long way across the plains. The dwarfs had harnessed mountain streams and built a staircase of locks that rose a mile up from the rolling grasslands, for the use of which they charged not just a pretty penny, but a very handsome dollar. Barges were always ascending or descending, making their way down the River Smarl and the cities of the plain. They carried coal, iron, fire clay, pig treacle. The treacle mines below Ankh-Morpork had long been exhausted, leaving only a street's name to remember them by. But the collision with the fifth elephant had buried thousands of acres of prehistoric sugarcane around the borders of Uberwald, and the resulting dense crystalline sugar was the foundation of a large mining, confectionery and dentistry industry. Oh, and fat, the dull ingredients of the pudding of civilization. In the sharp, thin air, they took several days to get out of sight. On a clear day, you could see next Wednesday. The captain of one of the barges, waiting for the top lock, went to tip the dregs of his teapot over the side and saw a small dog sitting on the snowy bank. It sat up and begged, hopefully. He turned to go back into the cabin, when he thought, what a nice little doggie. It was such a clear thought that it almost seemed to him that he'd heard it, but he looked around and there was no one else near him, and dogs certainly couldn't talk. He heard himself think, this little doggie would be very useful keeping down rats that might attack the cargo sort of thing. It must have been his thought, he decided. There was no one else nearby, and everyone knew dogs didn't talk. He said aloud, but rats don't eat coal, do they? He thought, clear as day, oh, well, you never know when they might try, right? Anyway, it's such a sweet-looking little doggie that's been struggling for days through deep snow. Ha! Not that anyone cares. The bargeman gave up. There's only so long you can argue with yourself. 10 minutes later, the barge was on the long drop to the plains, with a small dog sitting at the prow enjoying the breeze. On the whole, thought Gaspode, it was always best to look to the future. Nobby Nobbs had made himself a shelter up against the wall of the watch-house, and was gloomily warming his hands when a shadow loomed over him.
"What are you doing, Nobby?" said Carrot.
"Huh?
Captain? There's no one on the gates. There's no one on patrol. Didn't anyone get my message? What's happening?"
Nobby licked his lips.
"Well," he said, there isn't a watch at the moment, not per se."
He flinched. He saw anger behind Carrot.
Mr. Vimes with you at all?"
"What is happening, Nobby?"
"Well, you see, Fred kind of... And then he got all sort of... Then next thing you know, he was setting for to... And then we... And then he wouldn't come out... And then we... And he nailed at the door... And Mrs. Fred came and shouted at him through the letterbox... And most of the lads had gone off and got other jobs... And now there's just me and Dorful and Reg and Washpot... And we come here turn and turn about... And we shove food through the letterbox for him... And that's it, really."
"Can we have that again with the gaps filled in?"
said Carrot. This took considerably longer. There were still gaps. Carrot forced them open.
"I see," he said at last.
"Mr. Vimes is going to go spare, isn't he?"
said Nobby miserably. "I wouldn't worry about Mr. Vimes," said Angua. "Not at the moment." Carrot was looking up at the front door. It was thick oak. There were bars at all the windows.
"Go and fetch Constable Dorful, Nobby," he said.
10 minutes later, the watch-house had a new doorway. Carrot stepped over the wreckage and led the way upstairs. Fred Colon was hunched in the chair, staring fixedly at one solitary sugar lump.
"Be careful," whispered Angua. "He might be in a rather fragile mental state."
"That's very likely," said Carrot.
He leaned down and whispered,
"Fred?"
"Hmm?"
murmured Colon.
"On your feet, Sergeant! Am I hurting you? I ought to be. I'm standing on your beard. You've got 5 minutes to wash and shave and be back here with shining morning face. On your feet, to the washroom, about turn, at the double, 1-2, 1-2.
It seemed to Angua that no part of Fred Colon above the neck, except maybe for his ears, was involved in what happened next. Fred Colon rose at attention, executed a thudding about turn, and doubled out of the door. Carrot spun around towards Nobby.
"You too, Corporal!"
Nobby, trembling with shock, saluted with both hands at once and ran after Colon. Carrot went over to the fireplace and poked at the ashes.
"Oh, dear," he said.
"All burnt," said Angua.
"I'm afraid so."
Some of those heaps were like old friends.
"Well, we'll find out if we've missed anything important when it starts to smell," said Carrot.
Nobby and Colon appeared again, breathless and pink. There were a few bits of tissue stuck on Colon's face, where the shaving had been too enthusiastic, but he was nevertheless looking better. He was a sergeant again. Someone was giving him orders. His brain was moving. The world was the right side up once more.
"Fred," said Carrot.
"Yes, sir?"
"You've got a bit of bird doings on your shoulder."
"I'll see to that right now, sir," said Nobby, leaping sideways.
He dragged a handkerchief from his pocket, spat on it, and rubbed hurriedly at Colon's temporary pip.
"All gone now, Fred," he said.
"Well done," said Carrot.
He got up and went over to the window. It did not, in fact, offer much in the way of a view, but he looked out of it as if he could see to the end of the world. Colon and Nobby shifted uneasily. Right now they did not like the sound of silence. When Carrot did speak, they blinked as if struck in the face by a cold flannel.
"What I believe there has been here," he said, "is a confused situation."
That's right," said Nobby quickly. "We was very confused, Fred."
He jabbed Fred Colon with his elbow, waking him from a reverie of terror.
"Oh, right. Oh, yeah, confusion," he mumbled.
"And I'm afraid I know where the blame ultimately lies," Carrot went on, still apparently engrossed in the spectacle of a man sweeping the opera house steps.
In the silence, Nobby's lips moved in prayer. Only the whites of Fred Colon's eyes could be seen.
"It was my fault," said Carrot. "I blame myself. Mr. Vimes left me in charge, and I rushed off with no thought of my duty and put everyone in an impossible position."
Fred and Nobby were both wearing the same expression. It was the face of a man who has seen the light at the end of the tunnel, and it has turned out to be the twinkle of the Fairy of Hope.
"I feel almost embarrassed to ask you two to get me out of this pit I have dug for myself," said Carrot. "I can't imagine what Mr. Vimes is going to say."
The light at the end of the tunnel winked out for Fred and Nobby. They could imagine what Mr. Vimes would say.
"However," said Carrot.
He returned to the desk and pulled open the bottom drawer, extracting a few grubby pages that were clipped together. They waited.
"However, each of these men took the king's shilling and swore an oath to defend the king's peace," said Carrot, tapping the paper. "An oath, in fact, to the king."
"Yeah, but that was only..."
"Ah!"
said Fred Colon.
"Sorry, sir," said Nobby. "I inadvertently trod heavily on Fred's toe while standing to attention."
There was a long, drawn-out, silken sound. Carrot was drawing his sword from its sheath. He laid it on the desk. Nobby and Colon leaned away from its accusatory point. "They are all good lads," said Carrot softly.
"I'm sure if the two of you call on each and every one of them and explain the situation, they will see where their duty lies."
"Tell them?"
"Tell them there is always an easy way if you know where to look. And then we can get on with our jobs, and when Mr. Vimes returns from his well-earned holiday, the somewhat confused events of the past will be merely..."
"Confusing?"
suggested Nobby, hopefully.
"Exactly," said Carrot. "But I'm glad to see you made so much headway with the paperwork, Fred."
Colon stood nailed to the spot until Nobby, saluting desperately with the other hand, dragged him out of the office. Angua could hear them arguing all the way down the stairs. Carrot stood up, dusted off the chair, and placed it carefully under the desk.
"Well, we're home," he said.
"Yes," said Angua. And she thought, "You do know how to do nasty, don't you? But you use it like a claw. It slides out when you need it, and when you don't, there's no sign that it's there." He reached over and took her hand.
"Wolves never look back," he whispered.